Hi, welcome to BCI Cattle Chat. I'm Brad White, joined today by Dustin Pendle, Bob Larson, and Bob Weber. Morning, guys.
Yeah, good morning, gentlemen.
Hope everybody's having a good day today. We had a great day at our house the other day. We had it was a very special occasion because we took a steer to the locker and then we brought it home. When it comes home and you put it in the freezer, there's not much more exciting.
Because the decision is, what do we eat first?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. What do we eat first? Well, we had hamburgers and steak, and then we had cube steak the other night. So we've just been on a. And you're like, well, there's so much. We could eat anything.
Yeah. So you've got a lot of boys, and so it's. I'm not sure it is going to last as long as you think it's going to last.
Well, she got the hamburger made into, I think they're 2 pound packs.
Yeah,
So the question is, what is the first thing you had?
Yeah, we had hamburgers first, and then we had steaks, and then we're gonna keep going.
That kind of reminds me when I was in college, and my parents were very generous, so they would allow me to take meat from the locker to school, but there was a constraint on that. I got the cube steaks.
Yeah,
I had a whole freezer full of cube steaks all through college, and I don't want to sound ungrateful.
Because it was probably the same cube steaks. You just kept taking them. You never ate them.
No, I did eat them. I learned how, as a bachelor cooker, a bachelor chef, I learned how to cook cube steak in several different ways, but my parents loved it because then hey, it's time to kill another steer, and they keep the steaks and the roasts and things like that, and we'll send all the cube steaks with Bob.
That's perfect. Chicken fried steak twice a day.
That's not, as a bachelor could, though, that's
I
not
could,
that bad.
I could probably live
that
okay
is not that,
that way,
bad.
Yeah.
So
it's not a bad way to go.
Chicken fried steak for breakfast, chicken fried steak for supper.
Yeah, you're living the life I lived.
So it was a good day because we gotta enjoy and go through that, and then as you're sorting through, putting it in the freezer, you've got all those different things to look forward to, and when we're gonna
and the fun of cleaning out the freezer beforehand.
That wasn't as much fun as you might think.
I'm not surprised by that.
And we did find stuff in there that we had not seen for quite a while.
Yeah, and some oxtail from the last one.
Yep, exactly. Yeah. So there was some stuff that we figured out quickly that we could sort it out. But today, on today's show, we're going to talk about the Ag Credit Survey that has come out recently. We're also going to address a listener question, and it talks some about getting into stocker cattle or making stocker cattle work on your operation. Does it make sense or not? We'll talk a little bit about treatment protocols. What's the best way to put that together? Because it's fall with that changing weather. We know we're treating some calves, so what are the things we should look for? And talk some about traceability. As we dig into some of the things on the Ag Credit Survey, I wanted to mention a couple episodes ago, we had Forrest Bueller on, who talked about the CAMS program, or the Kansas Ag Mediation Service. And there's a Ag Mediation Service available in several states. You may want to go back and listen to that program. He also talked about succession planning, transitioning the ranch, and we'll touch on some of that today. Before we get into that, Dustin, you had some questions for us. Start off today.
So I was in Kansas City yesterday. Visited the USDA Economic Research Service.
Is new to Kansas City because they were located in Washington, D.C.
Well, they're still located in this Kansas City, and they still will always be located in Kansas City. It's just the majority of their employees, I think, will be housed in Kansas City at some point in the future. I think they said they're up to about 30 or 40 maybe employees there at this point, with the idea of maybe going a little over 200.
Well, it's nice to have them a little bit closer.
Yeah.
For me, yes, because then I can just run over to Kansas City when I need to work, do something with
Kansas
them for the day.
State University ag economists are the most important consideration when you think about where to house a federal agency.
Absolutely, yes. Yep. It's halfway between us and Missouri, so yeah. No other considerations needed. So, pulling some data from USDA Economic Research Service, we're going to talk about land values. Specifically, the question is, what's using 2018 dollars or 2018 prices, what's the average farmland value for just the 48 states in the U.S.? What's the average land value? And then we'll break it out by region.
Farmland or grassland or?
Everything.
All land.
Well, all land. We'll break it out by cropland and pasture here in a minute. But I just want to
give me a little bit of grace here. Because if you're thinking about, corn ground in the middle of Iowa versus.
Well, that will be in here.
Desert ground out in.
That is in there.
That will be in here.
Any guess I make is going to be very much a guess. So okay. I'm going to say 1,500.
I'm going to go a little bit higher, and I'm going to say 1,653.
Oh, that's pretty precise.
Yeah.
1,250.
So the total U.S. farm real estate value, which would include both cropland and pasture, is about
$3,100. Oh,
wow. Yeah. We're all way low.
Well, I thought, if anything, I thought it was going to be low. I thought you guys were going to go up from me, but there you go.
So the Corn Belt had the highest at about $6,400 on average. Lowest was in the mountain region at about $1,100.
Yeah. See, I thought that would have been lower. I think that's what I was thinking.
It's more acres to get any productivity. Yeah. I mean, in arid regions, you're going
to
have...
I thought it would be even lower than that in comparison to the Corn Belt ground.
Yeah.
So let's just take that $3,140 an acre. Let's break that into cropland and pasture. What are your takes on cropland value and pasture?
Let's set it at, I mean, like, to give you an average for each?
Average for cropland and average for pasture.
So average for cropland. Whole U.S. I'm going to put it at I don't know, 6,000, 5,000. And for pasture, right at 1,000.
I'm going to say 1,500 for pasture and 4,500 for crop.
I'm going to say 6,500 for crop ground and 1,200 for pasture.
Yeah, we're in the ballpark with each other.
I think we've got another first. Brad got them both right.
Oh. Whoa. Look at that. That never happens. I know. I think there's been collusion.
Cropland value is at $4,130 an acre, and pasture is at $1,390.
Okay. Yeah. So, those are closer together than I thought they would be.
I agree.
So the cropland value, the highest was the Pacific region, a little under 7,000. And the pasture, the highest, the lowest would be the mountains, but the highest would be the southeast at almost $4,000 an acre.
So lots of regional differences. There's
a lot of regional differences. So just taking a look at the average...
Doesn't tell you much, but it leads into that's a huge investment, and a lot of times when we talk about cattle, especially cattle production, is really land ownership and takes a lot of capital, requires a lot of credit to be able to maintain that operation, maintain that farm, and that leads us right into you had some information you found on that new ag credit survey.
So last week, came across a tweet, the Kansas City Fed Reserve put out their third quarter survey. So they do a survey of ag lenders in various states in their district, which I believe they're the 10th district. So it would be Colorado, Kansas, Nebraska, Oklahoma, Wyoming, parts of Missouri and New Mexico. And they surveyed 182 bankers, and they get their thoughts on kind of where we're headed from the ag finance space. But the title report was called Farm Finances Continue to Weaken Amid Ongoing Uncertainty. So I think that tells you probably a lot of what you want to hear.
Yeah, a little bit about the direction of where that report's going.
Yep. One thing I just want to point out, though, is just we were talking about farmland values. So in this particular 10th district, the land values for non-irrigated cropland, irrigated cropland were pretty much consistent. I mean, they haven't dropped
pretty
flat. And then ranch land is just a slight decline. But comparing 2019 to maybe 2018, 2017, 2016, as you guys can see, we're slightly improving. And so that kind of ties in with our question. The other thing I thought was pretty interesting was they actually had list comments. So when bankers have an opportunity to list comments, they actually report those comments on the survey.
Oh, interesting.
And so a couple things that came up that was similar across all were trade wars, uncertainty, how that was impacting prices, and crop prices, and ultimately all these other financial ratios, variables. The MFP, that market facilitation payment, saw the word saving grace a couple times, how that really has helped. Weather showed up a couple times, thinking about 2019, back to early. And then...
horrific, right?
Yeah. Yep. Although one of the comments from Central Kansas was they had really good... crop and that, or weather, which led to good crops, which actually has helped them.
Yep.
The other, there was at least several comments on equipment. And so they talked about how people were going to keep equipment longer as opposed to maybe getting rid of it, trading it, getting new equipment, but they were going to probably keep equipment longer.
And I think that's one of the challenges. Just like the investment in land, as you invest in equipment, you may invest in equipment when times are good, but you still have that payment even when
your prices go the other way.
Yeah, when your prices go the other direction.
Yep. So there's a lot of other information, useful information. Again, it's the Kansas City Fed Reserve. The title report was Farm Finances Continue to Weaken Amid Ongoing Uncertainty. So go take a look at it if you're interested in kind of what's happening in this 10th district.
And we'll put a link in the show notes to that full report if you want to go take a look at that. We will also, at any time, you can always send us a listener question at bci@ksu.edu.
And Bob love them.
Yeah, we love them. Having a good question. So, and Bob got one this week. And kind of tell us a little bit about what was your question.
So the question actually was a listener from Indiana who is getting into stocker cattle. It's a family transition and moving basically from a cow-calf operation, and he wants to do stocker cattle. But basically, it's a good question, but it's a pretty difficult question. And his question was, well, how do I make a living running stocker cattle? And that's both a very simple answer and an extremely complex answer. The simple answer is, well, you're going to need to do a really good job on buying and selling. You're going to need to keep the animals healthy, and you're going to need to grow them at a cost-effective rate of gain.
Yeah.
So that's the simple part of it. The hard part is implementation
of all that.
Yeah. There's a lot of pieces to that puzzle. And I may talk just a little bit about, so transitioning from cow-calf to stocker, there are some pros and cons just in that process, right?
Yes.
So it's a different type of labor, and a different frequency of labor.
And a different kind of financing, too.
And a different kind of financing.
You know, the speed that money comes in and comes out and the magnitude. Well, one of the things that I talked to him about was, you know, he was really interested in some of the resources that could come from universities and extension. And I provided him some links to what I think are some of the best sites. So I think, obviously, the Kansas State Ag Econ and Animal Science site, as well as the sites out of Nebraska and Iowa State and some others, I think have really good, valuable information. But then I tried to point out some of the things we were talking about earlier about averages, that I think the university and extension does a great job of kind of setting out what's typical and what is typically a good decision and those types of advice.
But you can't go just off averages.
But no, you can't. And that's what we talked about is develop that local knowledge. And so a local... someone that can help him locally market, and someone that can help him locally on the health side and the nutrition side is going to be really important. So the university fills a great role of doing research, providing kind of what's best in most situations or typical and ideal and those types of things. But then the actual management at that county or locality is going to have some local knowledge to really implement it well.
And I think there are a lot of principles that come into, I mean, we talk about stocker cattle, but livestock, a lot of the similar principles when you're investing in something that should appreciate in value. I mean, so we've got all the health production components on the side, but you're making a big investment and then you're going to be selling it later to either replace that investment or not. So similar principles to some of the big financial management decisions you might make.
Yep. And when you guys were talking through all these things, I had a colleague of mine at Colorado State, your fraternity brother, he always used to say, you know, just buy low, sell high.
Yeah.
Buy low, sell high.
Maybe that's where I learned that. Buy rice, half sold.
Yeah, it just keeps coming back in my mind. But absolutely, there's a lot of considerations when you're thinking about that in terms of the pricing, what your inputs, output price, how you're marketing it. It's all going to be local. You said it was in Indiana, correct?
Mm-hmm.
You know, Purdue's got a great extension. A couple former, actually, K-State ag economists are there, Jim Minard and Michael Langmeyer. And so, yeah, there's a lot of resources, I think, available to...
One of the things that comes to mind in Indiana, corn basis ought to be pretty favorable. I mean, supplementation ought to be pretty reasonably priced.
Yeah,
calf prices probably... purchase decision.
His access
there
is really coming out of, you know, Tennessee and Kentucky.
Tennessee and Kentucky. And then how do I get those calves moved west?
Right.
And so the marketing part is going to be a big deal in his outcome. So,
But you can build those relationships and figure out, I mean, because that could be your advantage. You want to have some competitive advantage over other people doing it. The other thing is, I mean, you may think outside the box. Are we talking about, should I look at stockers that are grazing corn stalks? Should I look at stockers that are doing something different than maybe what everybody else is? Am I going to go year round? Am I just going to go with the summer grazing? So there's lots of
Northern or Southern Indiana?
Southern Indiana.
So he's got some pretty reliable forage and fescue availability, and you know, winter grazing ought to be a pretty good opportunity for him.
And one of the things you've talked about before, Bob, is that we can't just make a decision once, right? So this year I'm going to do it this way, and so then next year just fall into that same decision process.
Always evaluate the opportunities.
Yeah, so yeah. you got to look at what's available. What does the forage base look like this year? What are some of the market things? And then I like the idea of, I really like asking somebody, right? He asked you, you guys had a great conversation, and you may not have answered every question, but you gave him some things to take in, and he could talk to some other people.
And I did point him to some of the folks at Purdue, both in the vet school and animal science department, as well as Ag Econ, because, and again, it points out that sometimes we don't know some of the resources that are even closer to us. And so, again, making those contacts and talking to people in the industry.
So as we look at, you talked about the straightforward approach, buy low, sell high. So we know your purchase price is important,
yep.
Your sale price is important. The other thing that you mentioned that I want to pick up on was our cost of gain, which could tie into value of gain. And we've had that discussion here before, and there's a podcast where we outline kind of the process of how you'd calculate that value of gain. But I want to talk a little bit about cost of gain, because that's the easier one to look at, which is essentially my total costs, feed costs being the big one, health costs, anything else, divided by how many pounds they gain. How do I try to manage that?
Well, I think there's... Again, it sounds simple. You want a relatively low cost of gain, but then the implementation is usually identifying feedstuffs that are going to be relatively inexpensive, but at the same time, I have to get the performance out of those feedstuffs. So again, I'm not just pricing feed on a per pound of feed basis. It's how much growth can I get from, again, and different situations. I might calculate it a slower rate of gain with a more forage-based diet, because that's the cheapest cost of gain. Or it may be something with a little higher supplementation. This particular operator was talking about that he has good access to distillers' grains and corn, and how best to use his competitive advantage where he is, like you mentioned, the corn basis. So what situation is going to work best for him might be different than a stocker operator in the Flint Hills of Kansas or Mississippi or something like that. And so... it is really about getting out the calculator and looking at, so what is going to be my cost for the rate of gains? Because he was asking those specific questions. Should I be targeting like a 2.5 pound daily gain or a 3.0 pound of daily gain? And I can't answer that until we know a little bit more about the feedstuffs that it would take to get types of gains.
Coupled with, so the complexity comes in, I may want to do a higher rate of gain to make sure that I meet a marketing window before I go and say a period. We got price seasonality and feeders, particularly. He's going to be able to potentially access a fair number of fall-born calves. So managing those and getting them marketed at the appropriate times may necessitate either accelerating or decelerating rate of gain
to get the
market window.
Exactly. Yeah.
So it's lots of moving pieces.
But you guys hit my point. Is it's not just feed cost. Right. It's also the rate of gain that influences that cost of gain, because you've got that maintenance every day. So you don't want to be too low. You want to get enough gain there, which leads us right to our BCI Cattle Chat checklist this week is on our top six tips for managing profitability in stockers.
All right. Number six is develop a grazing plan. So you're going to look at the forages that are available in your area and kind of the expected, changes throughout the year and between years so that you can optimize forage utilization.
Number five, risk management. It's critical to have a risk management plan in place. And by risk management, we're thinking the price risk. So you could talk about forward contracts, hedging, or LRP.
Number four, health management. So I want to have a protocol in place for what I'm going to do with those calves when they arrive and what I might do if they get sick, and work to come up with a plan to evaluate if that protocol is working.
Number three is a supplementation plan. So kind of you want to minimize those supplement costs, but make sure you provide adequate nutrients to leverage your grazing availability and your grazing plan.
All right. Number two is sell high. Basically have a marketing plan where you've identified where your cattle and where your operation fits is really, working with a local auction market or selling direct or having a relationship so that you can optimize the sell price of the product you're creating.
And number one is buying low. Again, it's having a plan or a strategy, whether it's for your particular operation, you're buying the lowest price or maybe lower value. But number one, buy low, and two, sell high are should be taken together.
And those are our top six tips for managing profitability in stocker calves. In addition to those topics, as we talk about having profit, one of the things we got to manage health, not just on the stocker operation, but even on the cow calf. This is a time of year that we may be treating calves, we may have calves, and I want to think about we think about respiratory disease in calves, but there are other things too that we encounter with those calves as they go through. And I wanted to talk a little bit about the importance of having a treatment protocol. So, Bob, I'm going to turn to you, and I'm going to say, if I'm putting together a treatment protocol, I'm working with my veterinarian, what are some of the considerations that I might have that I might want to include in that protocol?
Well, there's a lot of important things to consider. First of all is, what diseases am I looking at? And again, a couple of real common ones would, you'd have a protocol for respiratory disease. You might also have a protocol for a foot rot or some other things that you're going to run into. And the veterinarian is going to help you select a drug based on, you know, experience with how successful that is. So, you know, is this antibiotic a good match for the bacteria that causes particular disease? Because there's some differences. So some antibiotics work better on certain types of bacteria than others. So that's going to be the first part of the decision. Treatment frequency. There are some products that you need to give every day, others that have multi-day extended duration. So that's going to impact the decision. And then other things such as even just syringeability and ease of giving the product. So those become kind of first, and cost, I should add. So those become kind of the first line decision. And then usually you have a second line if an animal doesn't respond to the first treatment, a second treatment that would be different or hit the bug from a different direction is often what we look at. Now, so you want a logical plan of first and second treatments based on a lot of things, including cost, but efficacy is really what's driving this. How effective do I think this product is going to be? And then one of the things that I think is important to think about is, this is a protocol, and so you'll want to treat it that way and stick with it and treat every animal the same, so that, and one of the reasons we do that is so that we can evaluate, is this particular protocol working? And so I'm going to balance that.
That's key, because our memory is fallible, and we've talked about that before. We remember stuff that didn't respond the way we thought it should.
Right, and having the records to go back to, and you talk about second line. Well, part of the whole second line decision is, well, how many days post first treatment do I draw the line, and then what are the criteria for this one didn't respond to first line treatment that I actually need to implement? Because it might be that they responded and they just haven't completely recovered. Well, does that necessitate round two or not? And so having a good discussion about, well, how do I, because you don't want to let them go too long, but you also don't want to incur
additional costs
and use antibiotics you don't need to use. And so have that, that's to me always the gray spot, and that veterinarian input can be really helpful in delineating those decision points.
But there's stuff that you, there's also, and I like the, for the second treatment, but then as you go into the future, there are things that, so the boys had a calf this year that had a broken leg, right? So we're going to remember what number that calf is when he, we've managed the calf for a long time. It's not very common. We get to fall and we're getting the calves together and we're like, well, which one had a broken leg? Right. And had we not written it down, I don't know that we'd have remembered, because you think, well, and maybe that's just a sign of my poor memory, but you'd think you'd remember that type of stuff. But
it's really good. It's just really short, Brad. That's the problem.
It just doesn't last very long. That's a good way to put it. But you got to write that stuff down. And especially on those treatments,
because you
which calves did I treat? Which calves did I not treat? And then how many responded? Because we will tend to overestimate the amount of, if it had a negative response. Yeah. So if I treated this calf and it died, overestimate the failures, whereas there might have been eight that I treated that did fine. So I don't necessarily need to change my treatment based on that.
Yeah. And that's a reason to just keep some records. And again, the good thing in most of beef cattle production, that the amount of records we need is not tremendous. I mean, it's just write some things down that you want to make decisions about.
And that helps tie us to our cost too.
Absolutely. You want to know what you're, I mean, a lot of your production records, then also if you can keep some of those financial records, we'll come back and, at the end of the day, it can help quite a bit.
Well, and tying that back to our stalker conversation, health cost is going to be one of the factors in that decision. So you want to have good records on not only what does my health, what do I anticipate my health cost to be, but I can also use that when I'm building my break evens.
Yeah, no, you can use that for pre and post financial stuff.
Yep. Excellent. Well, we have appreciated you joining us today. And as always, if you have a topic or something that you would like to send to us that you'd like us to discuss, send us an email at bci@ksu.edu.